first reaction is, ooh, this sounds a little scary, like we're still going to have severe cuts.
The Senate Finance Committee introduces a new education funding package. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the man in charge of managing wildlife at Sitka's airport.
So we'll be talking to the pilot 5 to 7 miles from the airport if we can see him, telling him, hey, you have eagles.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
In Juneau, the latest version of the education funding bill emerged today, and it isn't what school advocates were hoping for. Senate Finance Co-Chairman Kevin Meyer says it's a comprehensive bill that would add $100 million to education, and he says the majority is committed to keeping those funds in the budget for each of the next 3 years. He distributed copies in his committee room this afternoon.
Some things you're going to like, some things you may not like. But hopefully overall, it's going to be a balanced package that everyone can support.
As they studied the pages, education advocates in the front row looked grim. Elise Galvin, an Anchorage parent and activist, left the room to study it further.
My first reaction is, ooh, this sounds a little scary, like we're still going to have severe cuts now, and particularly even more so in the future, because if it is flat, that means that it's not keeping up with any sort of inflation costs.
Senator Meyer says the funding amounts to a $300 increase in the BSA, referring to the per student allocation. But Meyer says the money would not come through the BSA. The bill describes a series of special programs for internet upgrades and charter schools, boarding schools, and vocational education. Galvin says the special programs may look good, but they are funds the legislature can give and take. She says the BSA provides stable funds that schools can rely on.
I think that their methodology is different than what parents want to see. I think they're missing the boat that most kids are in neighborhood schools, and most parents are seeing neighborhood schools get cuts.
Meyer says only about a quarter of the $100 million will fund special programs, and the rest will go to school districts to use as they like. Education isn't the only thing left on the legislature's plate. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez is our Capitol correspondent, and she's joining us to walk us through what lawmakers need to do in the 60 hours before they gavel out. Hi, Alexandra.
Hello, Lori.
So what's the legislature's workload look like right now?
It's huge. At the start of session, the governor said he wanted action on education, on a gas line project, and on retirement. None of that is done. In addition to the education bill, the Senate still needs to move on their plan for dealing with the public employee retirement system. There's been reluctance to adopt the pension payment plan on the Senate side because they don't want to obligate future legislatures to make these massive annual payments as they are seeing oil revenues decline. They still want to put money in. They've said, okay, we're going to meet that constitutional obligation, but they don't want to have a dollar figure like the governor is proposing. But at least the Senate's got most of the major bills out of its court. The House is in much more dire shape. They're still dealing with the gas line bill in committee, and they also haven't released their capital budget. And since coming up with a budget is the legislature's one constitutional obligation, that's a pretty big deal.
Well, what are the prospects for getting all of that done by their deadline?
Well, they're definitely not getting out early. Even though political leadership had wanted to get out before Easter Sunday, having the capital budget still unfinished kills that hope because the capital budget needs to sit for 24 hours before representatives can even vote on it. The legislature could still finish by midnight on Sunday, but that's only if everything goes to plan.
Alexandra, explain for us what happens if they run late.
Well, nothing really happens to the legislature. They can extend the session for another 10 days if they so choose, while keeping all outstanding bills moving. They could also end their regular session and go into special, focusing only on bills they really want to let live. But there are potentially huge impacts to the elections. If the legislature gavels out late, it could push citizens' initiatives to regulate marijuana, slow down the proposed bubble mine, and hike up the minimum wage off the ballot. Those initiatives are seen as attracting liberal-minded voters that might also support a referendum to repeal the new oil tax law, which would still stay on the ballot.
Last week, the House passed a minimum wage bill that would have preempted one of those initiatives in a pretty tight vote. Have we seen any action there?
We haven't. Before the House even took up that bill for a vote, a number of senators had said they don't support it either because they don't want to be perceived as electioneering or because they're just not that into the bill itself. So we haven't even seen a meeting scheduled, but there's kind of a game of chicken going on where a number of the Senate's priority bills have been outstanding. The House, for example, the House has had a bill to advance a Kinnickarm Bridge project, which is a priority of the Senate president for a while now. They also have an omnibus crime bill that's a priority of the majority leader. And because they still have their hands on the Capitol budget, they are kind of in a position of power in terms of as far as funding is concerned. But so far, we haven't seen anything there. It's something where, you can't rule it out, but there's definitely reluctance on their side to touch the issue.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, Alexandra, and good luck this weekend.
Thanks, Lori.
That was APRN's Capitol correspondent, Alexandra Gutierrez, joining us from Juneau. A series of earthquakes rattled northwest Alaska, about 40 miles northeast of Kotzebue, this morning. The tremors began with a strong 5.6 magnitude earthquake at 10:44 this morning.
It's a very striking earthquake. I'm not aware of anything in that area in the last 30 years anywhere close in size.
That's Michael West, a state seismologist and the director of the Alaska Earthquake Center in Fairbanks. He says the initial quake was one of the largest on record for the region and was followed by a series of less powerful quakes, including a 5.3 magnitude aftershock that struck just 12 minutes later.
We've recorded at least 10 or so aftershocks in the last couple of hours. I'm quite sure there are many more that are much smaller.
The quakes occurred about 20 miles northeast of Noatak, a community of 500. The massive zinc mining operation at Red Dog is also 20 miles from the center of the series of quakes. Staff at the Noatak school say it shook the whole building for nearly a minute. Ice fishermen on the Noatak River report it pushed water through their fishing hole and up on top of the ice. Here's Amy Mitchell, a health aide in training at the Noatak Clinic.
We have a VHF here, and people were going on that. Our other health aide and our supervisor were telling people to go under tables and under the door frame. Interesting and scary for me.
Despite rattling buildings, no damage or injuries have been reported. State troopers say they've received no calls asking for help or reporting damage. No tsunamis are expected, according to the Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer. Seismologist West says there's no evidence suggesting the quakes are a prelude to something bigger. Dozens of aftershocks continued throughout the day, but West says the seismic activity should die down by next week.
Our alarms have been going crazy all morning with each one of these sort of updating into our system. But they'll die off over the course of the coming days.
The Earthquake Information Center reports the quake was felt as far away as Kotzebue. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Talkeetna climbers react to today's tragedy on Everest.
Not like climbers go up and have this death wish and kill themselves. It's like, for the most part, you can stay safe in these areas.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Representatives from the Recall Lindsey Holmes Group and Alaska's Division of Elections met in State Superior Court yesterday. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
The two sides are arguing over the state's rejection of a petition to recall Anchorage Representative Lindsey Holmes, who switched parties from Democrat to Republican just days before the 2013 legislative session was set to gavel in. Elizabeth Bacalar represents the Alaska Division of Elections. She says the recall process is aimed at dealing with issues of misconduct that arise during a representative's time in office. And because the event took place before Holmes was sworn in, the circumstances deal more with the candidacy and primary process, which is separate.
It's a political discontent, not legal discontent, that's reflected in the grievances. And the remedy lies with the voters at a regular election and not in a special recall election and not with this court today.
The recall effort began shortly after Holmes made the announcement in early 2013. Over the next several months, the Recall Lindsey Holmes Group gathered 904 signatures, turning them into the State Division of Elections in November, nearly 100 more than were necessary. Roughly a month later, the Division of Elections rejected the petition, saying the effort to recall Holmes did not meet the requirements laid out by the state constitution. Louis Tazi, who represents the Recall Lindsey Holmes Group, disagrees with that assessment, arguing a, quote, lack of fitness on the part of Representative Holmes, which would allow the recall effort to move forward.
The issue is, we believe that Ms. Holmes corrupted the intent of the closed primary and that she raised money disingenuously, made misrepresentations to the voters, and that the voters, especially the contributors, feel defrauded by that.
At the close of the hearing, Judge Gregory Miller said he would take the arguments into consideration and issue a written opinion at a later date. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The National Transportation Safety Board has published a preliminary report about the crash that killed two pilots near Three Step Mountain. KYUK's Ben Matheson reports.
Investigators still don't know what caused the Cessna 208 to crash, but they are digging through data sent from the aircraft that could give some clues. The data showed that the plane was flying at about 3,400 feet when its altitude quickly changed. Clint Johnson is the NTSB Regional Office Chief.
That there was a deviation in altitude, probably two different deviations. Immediately after that, the airplane went into a very, very steep dive, a very rapid dive, and continued all the way to ground impact.
Investigators on the ground found that the wreckage traveled about 180 feet before stopping in an area of heavy brush. A post-crash fire burned much of the fuselage. The NTSB is investigating other fatal crashes among the Raven, formerly ERA, family of companies. Johnson says they are individual accidents at this point, but they are looking for similarities among the accidents.
But at this point right now, at this juncture, especially for this most recent accident, we need to be able to center in on the facts that surround this accident. But that may come a little later on where we start connecting the dots and see if there are similarities throughout the accidents, whereas training, FAA oversight, maintenance procedures, there's a whole litany of things. And again, it's a process of elimination. At this point, nothing has been eliminated.
The plane was not equipped with cockpit voice or data recorders and was not required to have them. The plane's wreckage is in Bethel now and will be sent to Anchorage. A full report from the NTSB is expected in about a year. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
A deadly incident claimed the lives of at least 12 Sherpas today on Mount Everest. Willie Pretty and Ellie Henke, both residents of Talkeetna, have extensive experience on Everest and spoke to KTNA's Philip Manning about the incident.
Even with the most current gear and knowledgeable guides, mountain climbing carries inherent risk. Willie Pretty has led 6 expeditions on Mount Everest and currently works as a coordinator for a guide service on Denali. He says that major incidents remind people of the risks involved in trying to reach the world's tallest peaks.
It's a roll of the dice whether or not you're going to be there when something big moves or not, and people forget that. They forget that you are incurring risk anytime you're going through an area like this. just like you would when you get in your vehicle and you drive down the park's highway, you're incurring risk. Well, we tend to forget that as well. We seem to have a very convenient memory as a species on these sorts of things.
On Friday, reports conflicted regarding where the avalanche actually took place. Willie says that the description that makes the most sense is that the avalanche was in the area of the Khumbu Icefall. Willie Pretty says the Alaska Range also has a number of large icefalls, but that climbing routes avoid them because of differences in conditions.
Something of that size and scale here in Alaska is far more active, and you'd have to have a death wish to walk into it.
Speaking about Friday's tragedy, Ellie Henke, who managed base camp for 10 seasons of Everest expeditions, says that using the word avalanche may be premature.
Because it could have been something like a serac collapse. It could have been ice fall from way up on the west ridge somewhere coming quite a distance down. It's at this point, boy, I haven't heard anything that tells exactly what this was.
The story of the Everest incident resonates in Talkeetna, the launch point of nearly all expeditions on Denali. Willie Pretty says that while there are environmental hazards to contend with, the most popular route to North America's tallest peak is very different from the climb up Mount Everest. On much of Denali, the danger does not come from avalanches above climbers, but cracks in the ice, or crevasses, below their feet.
Generally, the majority of those crevasses will be covered over by wind and snowfall in the wintertime, and you're often crossing many hundreds of snow bridges without even knowing those crevasses are down there. Well, the quality of the snow on top of those snow bridges deteriorates as the season warms up, and so hidden crevasses are probably the single biggest problem.
Despite the dangers, Willie Pretty says the reason stories like the Everest tragedy make news is that they're fairly uncommon.
It's not like climbers go up and have this death wish and kill themselves. It's like, for the most part, you can mitigate a lot of these risks, and you can stay safe in these areas. And even look at Everest. You know, there's been many thousands of people up and down there in the last couple of decades or so. And this is the first one of these incidents that's happened in a very, very long time there.
Conditions and the lack of an official agency like the National Park Service in the U.S. mean that it could be a while before the full details emerge of exactly what happened to claim the lives of 12 or more Sherpas on the world's highest mountain. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein. Online at LBBLawyers.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Margaret Friedenauer. This week on AK, hazing birds. At most major airports, someone is paid to chase birds off the runway. But at Sitka's airport, that job is especially challenging. That's because three-fourths of Sitka's runway is surrounded by water. Fish spawn along its banks, attracting hungry birds. That problem was highlighted 4 years ago when two Alaska Airlines jets collided with eagles on takeoff. KCAW's Emily Foreman spoke with the expert, who came in afterward to make sure the runway is safe.
Snarge. That's the technical term Dave Tresham uses to describe unidentifiable bird debris. Avoiding snarge is the goal. It's also the reason he's speeding up and down Sitka's runway 30 minutes before the noon flight departs for Ketchikan. He spots some loafing eagles at the end of the runway and stops the truck.
Now we have two eagles. So the more you leave the birds alone, the more will show up.
Tresham chooses a small hand pistol loaded with pyrotechnic shells, aptly called screamers. Screamers tend to work best on eagles who don't fear much at the top of the food chain, because when triggered, the screamers spiral wildly and shoot sparks. That's what it takes to rattle an eagle. Tresham is a U.S. Department of Agriculture wildlife specialist stationed at Sitka's Rocky Gutierrez Airport. He notices patterns in bird activity at a very micro level. He has his eye on every tuft of grass, puddle, and critter.
So many times I'll spend an hour or 2 hours picking bugs and worms up off the runway.
Really? You'll go to that level of detail?
I have pictures of night crawlers. There's an isopod, it's called a rock louse, that is supposed to stay within a few feet of the shoreline. And I've picked up literally hundreds of them out toward the center line of the runway.
Tresham has been modifying Sitka's causeway since 2010. In August that year, an Alaska Airlines flight was forced to abort takeoff when a bald eagle was sucked into its left engine. That same week, the replacement plane also hit an eagle on takeoff. No people were injured, only birds. But after that, Tresham was hired to come up with a long-term plan for deterring wildlife from making the Sitka runway home. That includes things like filling in still water with gravel or trimming down tall patches of grass.
So is there basically like a Dave Tresham at every airport?
there's many, yes. We probably have, I think, close to 30 USDA wildlife specialists working the state of Alaska alone.
Tresham's career started with the Aleutian cackling goose. His first wildlife management job was removing an invasive species of fox that was preying on the cackling goose to the point of endangerment. He's devoted a lot of time to kicking animals out of places where they shouldn't be, but he loves wildlife. It's tough love.
I just show up for work even when I'm not working because it's nice to see the birds, to see the populations, to, you know, just look at the scenery. You have whales and sea lions. Where else can you do that?
Tresham says the job has turned him into an avid bird watcher. Makes sense. That's what the job requires. But he's also become a really tense airplane passenger. His seasonal assistant, Heather Bauscher, agrees.
You're like, all right, where's the wildlife person? Oh, I see birds. Why isn't anybody doing anything about that?
They are both much more comfortable on the ground, a stone's throw away from a 737 as it's taking off, because that's where they have the most control.
We have, just to the south on their approach, we'll have 3 to 4, maybe 5 eagles are flying from those trees. From this distance, those birds have felt that banger going off.
A banger is used with a 24-gauge shotgun. It's a longer-range shell than the screamer, loud and resonant.
And if anything starts coming this route, I'll be talking to the pilot, letting them know where the birds are at.
Tresham can literally change the course of a speeding plane minutes before it lands.
So we have eagles above them, eagles below them, eagles in front of them. So we'll be talking to the pilot 5 to 7 miles from the airport if we can see him, telling him, hey, you have eagles.
In the very last resort is what Tresham calls a lethal take. He says he probably chases away close to 80,000 birds a year in Sitka, and he relies on the lethal take method a lot. It's usually a glaucous wing gull that just doesn't get the picture, but endangered species are off limits. The noon flight to Ketchikan is almost ready to depart. Tresham sees a few eagles flying overhead and takes one more precautionary shot at clearing the runway.
Safe departure.
And in Sitka, there's another successful takeoff without a fragment of snarge in sight. For AK, I'm Emily Foreman.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Akyacek in southwest Alaska. The village is the first in the state to formally decide to dissolve its local government in favor of traditional tribal representation.
It's Jonathan Lomack. I'm the executive director for Akyacek Native Community Tribal Government. Yeah, it's the native community, the remote village located 13 air miles from Bethel. There's no road system outside of the village other than trails. The only way to get in is through either a local airplane or a snow machine in the winter or boat in the summer. We're on the Kuskokwim River. That's the main activity that we do in the village, subsistence hunting all year round. fishing in the summer, berry picking, gathering into fall. We do have a tribal government that runs the village. There's a village corporation that runs with the regional corporation. Well, Akichuk was incorporated in a second-class city in 1974, and then in January 31, 1990, the city government was dissolved in favor of traditional village council governance. There's sports, like student activities on the UP school district. We do sponsor dog races in the winter carnival. There's usually a bingo parlor for adults. Most of the village is related. I guess everybody knows everybody in the village. We grew up here. Some have left the village to pursue any jobs in college, but most of them have stayed in the village.
Jonathan Lomack is the executive director for Akiacek Native Community Tribal Government. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Foreman, Jolene Almendarez, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Margaret Friednauer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Philip Manning from Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with Dennis Hayes, CEO of the world's most energy-efficient commercial building, on Thursday, May 1st, during the 6th Annual Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dynina Center. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.